time now for the nationally syndicated radio show, The World of Lori Zook. And now, here she is, the smart, the sexy, the savvy, Divine Miss C.
And welcome to the show. Now, today, we'll be discussing primaries, general elections, and the Electoral College, three hot topics often discussed in the media. I think it's important to understand these topics correctly, and I'm not an expert. So I have two people today on the show who can accurately explain these topics, and they're both from New York City. With me today is Dr. Barbara Chernow. She is an early American historian who was associate editor of the papers of Alexander Hamilton and has written on the subject of early American finance. She's the author of Beyond the Internet, Successful Research Strategies, and was the editor of the fifth edition of the Columbia Encyclopedia. She's taught both at New York University and the New School. Welcome, Barbara, to the show.
Thank you, Rory.
Thanks. Now, also with me is Andy Feinberg. Andy has written about politics and finance for almost 40 years for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Playboy. He is the author of the new novel, 4 Score and 7, which imagines Abe Lincoln has come back to life during the 2016 presidential campaign. He also writes the Me Baby Don Don site on Facebook, which provides daily humorous commentary about Donald Trump. So welcome back, Andy.
Nice to be with you, Laurie.
Thank you. All right. Well, we all hear what's going on TV. People are outraged. No one knows really how it works. I don't really know how it works. I thought I did, but I don't. So that's why I have the two of you on the show today. So we're going to start out with some basic things. So, Barbara, I'll start with you first. Can you explain some of the election terminology? I mean, what is the difference between the direct election and the indirect election of candidates?
In a direct election, the popular vote would be the determining factor. Whoever gets the most votes wins the election. In an indirect election, you're not voting directly for somebody. You're voting for an elector or a delegate who will then cast a vote for you based upon your state's vote. A referendum would be, again, a majority decision, but with a referendum you can sometimes say there has to be a minimum number, a minimum percentage of people agreeing. So the Brexit vote in England, which was really disastrous for them, might have been smarter had David Cameron said, we're doing a referendum, but we need a 65% vote. So it's a question of whether majority rules or whether you're and you're electing directly or if you're electing an elector or a delegate who will then vote for you. A majority of the vote obviously is more than 50%. A plurality means there were more than two candidates, but you still got more votes than the others. Didn't necessarily get a majority.
Okay. And Andy, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, what I would add, and one reason so much of this is convoluted, is the Founding Fathers had some fear of democracy, fear of mob rule, and just fear that the majority might make some bad decisions, and Brexit's an interesting example. So, they said at the beginning that electors would be selected by the state legislature when choosing the president. So this goes back to the founding.
Right, but Andy, they also, when they set up the college, the Electoral College, made it the same number of representatives as you have in the House. And the House is the people's House. So there was, again, a checks and balances going on.
That's right.
Well, let me ask you both the question. You brought up a point about what I want to talk about here actually is the popular vote. Was it ever a popular vote? And if it was, why did it change?
No, it was never a popular vote.
So why was it not a popular vote?
Because the Founding Fathers were very smart about checks and balances. No branch of the government has absolute power. No section of the country has absolute power. The Electoral College and the fact that we vote by state for president in the Electoral College manages to protect small states against large states, one part of the country, from dominating the election. You can't win the presidency by winning just the South or just the East or just the West. You have to put together votes from all different sections of the country. And that was a form of balance, a form of checks and balances.
Okay.
By the way, Lori, yes. When the country was first founded, we did not elect senators by popular vote either. That was a constitutional amendment.
Okay. All right. Well, let me ask Andy. So then why do we have indirect election of the president? And I know Barbara addressed a little bit about why did the founding fathers specify this in the Constitution? You're saying that they were afraid. Are you saying that they're afraid of one state, overdoing it and the little states would be punished?
Yes. Well, they were very – and the mm-hmm. small states yeah. were afraid that, like, Virginia would have much more power than they would have. And so the Electoral College is one way of guaranteeing that the small states, they have at least three electors if they have just one, mm-hmm. Two senators and one congressman. And that may not seem like a lot, but in a very close election, it can matter. And now the problem we have today is that the swing states, and it's going to presumably happen again this year, determine the outcome of the election. And so the joke is, like in Ohio or Florida, where you are,
right?
The airwaves have almost nothing but commercials. When it's coming toward election time, commercials for politicians, for the presidential candidates. And, it's never happened, but you could win, get your 270 electoral votes by just carrying 11 states.
Okay.
One of them is Texas, which tends not right. to be a blue state.
But they wouldn't, Andy, all be in the same part of the country.
That's right. Exactly.
You have to have votes from different states, different parts of the country.
Okay, so I'm a little confused here. What are swing states?
Well, swing states are states like, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, which sometimes go Democratic and sometimes go Republican, and especially the way the electoral map plays out, Donald Trump, assuming he gets the nomination, will have to carry, many of those, presumably to get, since things like New York and California are Democratic, and there's almost no chance for a Republican to win. So these are the ones that could go either way, and the candidates keep coming to them, and the ads run like crazy, and I don't think the founders foresaw that, but it's not necessarily a terrible thing.
No.
But some parts of the country, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Andy, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, so some parts of the country can feel ignored, and it's similar to the primaries that mm-hmm. usually New York and California are late and irrelevant because states like Iowa and New Hampshire even has a state law about that they're the first primary, which I think is
wow.
a bizarre state law.
Yeah.
But we'll talk later about reforms, but clearly Iowa and New Hampshire are not very representative states. They're very white.
Mm-hmm.
They're richer than the people are richer, and it's Iowa is particularly conservative. So that's something that probably doesn't work in the interest of democracy.
But there's also, Lori, a question of protecting the minority from the majority. This election process we follow prevents urban areas from dominating, prevents rural areas from dominating urban areas, fundamentalists from dominating the less religious. It requires that you get votes from a diverse group and from states with different population demographics. So
that's
it's a
absolutely
way of protecting people.
I'm sorry?
No, go ahead, Andy. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I was going to say, if we went to a popular vote, there is fear that people would campaign in the biggest cities, that that would be the most efficient way, and that rural areas might get ignored in a way that they're not ignored today.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. I mean, I still find it, I know you're explaining it, I still find it confusing because in my mind, I would think the popular vote would be the most fair, because if everybody did come out to vote or did vote in the primaries, it kind of gives you a feel for what most people want. And because a lot of lower income people may not go out and vote, or, you know, they just don't do it, then in a way it seems unfair to me to do it the way that it's being done. If that makes sense.
The way it's done affords, it may need some revision, but it affords protection, and it has worked quite successfully for more than 200 years. It does protect the weak from the small. It does protect immigrants. It protects minority groups. It gives everybody in every setting a voice, a significant voice in the election. Otherwise, Sandy said some parts of the country would be irrelevant in an election.
Now, explain that, though. I'm not understanding. How would they be irrelevant?
Because they wouldn't have enough people in them for the vote to count substantially. Let's say you had all Jewish voters living in a small state with only three votes. In a very small state, they almost wouldn't count. But because immigrants live in large urban centers, because minority groups live in large urban centers in states that have a lot of votes in the Electoral College, they get a voice, a significant voice in an election they might not have if it was just a popular vote, where they could be overruled very easily by a fundamentalist white male-dominated electorate.
Okay. Now, I'm going to kind of throw a doozy of a question out here for you. Okay, you know me. A lot of people aren't happy with either choice, with Hillary Trump or with Hillary Clinton or with Donald Trump. Is there any – if people aren't happy, I always thought there should be a line that you could check off that says none of the above and then reforce the issue, because you really have two people that I don't think either of them are going to make a great choice for president. And it's going to come down to the usual, the lesser of two evils. So I want to hear each of your comments. Andy, I'll start with you on that one.
Well, there, you know, we have a third and a fourth party candidate this year. One of the weird things is some states in the primaries, if you were going to write in someone, you might have to specify what delegates
okay.
go with that person, which is knowledge that might not even exist. So I think, on your point, this week we may see. It's very unlikely, but the Republicans dump Trump. That one of the bizarre things about conventions is that they make the rules can be there are set each convention. So, like what Barbara said about the Brexit vote, if they wanted to demand a supermajority of delegates, otherwise you don't get the nomination, Trump would not meet that super. They could create a supermajority number that Trump would not meet. That would seem undemocratic to me. And I think I just find it bizarre that you could change the rules every 4 years sort of to, you know.
Well,
but
yeah, that's what seems to be happening, because if the Republicans weren't happy with Donald Trump, and, you know, you can read a million articles. Yes, they are. No, they're not. It goes back and forth. No one really knows yet if he's going to have that nomination. And I read an article yesterday that said something about Ron Kasich being called back to the Republicans. And it seems like they want to change the rules. It's like changing the rules in the middle of a sports game because your side isn't winning.
Right. Well, except unlike sports, it is allowed. It is strange.
But you also have to tell the electorate, the people who are voting, have an obligation as well. Donald Trump has the nomination because those Republicans who voted in the primary voted for him. So if you're not happy with either choice, the voters should have voted differently.
Right. Well, when people go and vote in a primary, it's to figure out who they think is going to get the nomination. Let me ask you a little bit. Okay, let's talk about the primaries and the indirect election. When did they first become the standard? Barbara, you can start with that one.
there were primaries on and off since the 1800s, but really after 1968 with that very tempestuous Democratic convention, the primary system took hold in a way it hadn't before. And they occur at different times during the year. They're staggered in part so that the candidates can stretch out their campaigning and not have to cover all the states at one time the way they do in a presidential election. It was intended to give the people the voice in the nomination and pull the nomination away from the boys in the back room, which is how it was done up until then. Party leaders met. Party leaders knew who the strong candidates were. They knew who had the clout, to whom they had obligations and debts. They selected experienced people, but it was a somewhat collusive process, and conventions were much more exciting, and everybody's talking about the Republican convention as, wow, it might be contested, but really, until 68, conventions were contested. You didn't know going in who was going to be the nominee.
Okay. Anything to add to that, Andy?
Oh, sure, two things. Well, we'll get, you know, in 1924, the Democrats had 103 ballots before they chose a nominee. But in 1968, Hubert Humphrey, who got the Democratic nomination, ran in one primary, which is astonishing. It was the classic, you know, the people had no say in who got the nomination, and it was decided that was not a good thing.
Okay.
But Andy, one thing it did do that the primaries are kind of weak at is the primary system allows somebody who has no experience but a lot of money to manage to get a place on the ballot.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I want you guys to stay with me. We are going to go to a quick commercial break, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Central Payment, your number one credit card merchant service provider in the industry, providing e-commerce solutions, POS systems, standalone terminals, mobile apps, and much more. Call Central Payments' James Carner at 813-777-4332. Looking for the lowest rates in the industry and number one customer service? Call Central Payments' James Carner at 813-777-4332. That's James Carner, 813-777-4332.
Welcome back to the show. We're talking about primaries, general elections, and the Electoral College. And I have with me Barbara Chernow and Andy Feinberg. We've been discussing that topic. And so I want to kind of get an idea. I go and I vote in a primary. Andy, what happens when I vote in that primary? How does it progress up?
Well, it does vary from state to state. But
more confusion, yes.
Yes. And let me take Pennsylvania for 1 second. In the Republican, there were 17 delegates that were chosen where your vote, you know, for Trump would go toward getting one of those 17 delegates. He carried the state. But there were 54 other delegates who were unbound, who just show up at the convention, and they can be wooed by any candidate. And that's an extreme case. What usually happens is that a state can have a winner-take-all, where if the person you vote for has the plurality, they get all the delegates.
Okay.
Some of the states, like California, you go by congressional district, and some have a combination of you get a certain number of delegates for winning the state, and then it depends how many congressional districts you carry. Then there's the question, and I can let Barbara handle this, of to what extent the delegates are how they're chosen. In fact, they're chosen later, often at a convention in the state. So where your vote the units for the winning candidate could get diluted by who is actually selected. And there was a lot of drama that,
yes,
that Ted Cruz did a better job of wooing delegates than the Trump campaign did, and he did.
All right, so let me ask Barbara then. You know, Andy's saying each state has its own rules. Well, my first question would be, why aren't the rules the same for all of the United States?
Because the primaries are not federally controlled.
Okay.
The primaries are controlled by the parties. And you can have, as Andy said, you can have a state with caucuses where people don't go to polling places to vote but rather go to political gatherings and cast their ballots. It's a rather inconvenient way to do it. You can have states like the Republicans tend to have more states where there's winner-take-all. Whoever wins the popular vote wins all of the delegates from that state. When they go to the convention, they're supposed to vote for the winner. Other states have proportional. If you win the Democrats have proportional primaries. So if Hillary Clinton wins 52% of the votes in New York and Bernie Sanders 48%, they split the delegates that way. There are also superdelegates. That's the big deal with the Democrats.
Okay.
Superdelegates are selected by party leaders, and they tend to vote for the candidate preferred by the party and the favored candidate, which is why Hillary Clinton has such a large number of them.
Perfect example of how the superdelegates function, that they're the elected officials. Every Democratic congressman and senator is a superdelegate, and so they are the establishment, and they would and almost unanimously prefer Hillary Clinton to Bernie Sanders. And if Republicans have only three superdelegates per state and territory, so in a way, the Democratic Party ends up being less Democratic than the, mm-hmm, because of the superdelegates. And it is, depending on how you feel about the establishment, this is either a good thing or a very bad thing. It certainly makes a Bernie Sanders, he could have won more pledged delegates than Hillary Clinton and still lost the nomination because of the superdelegates, which might have caused such an uproar that the system may change it anyway.
But he didn't, and that may end with the point.
All right, so it's still somewhat convoluted, although I'm starting to understand. So, Barbara, can you explain what is the difference between a delegate and a superdelegate?
A delegate is theoretically chosen by the people when they go and vote. A superdelegate's chosen by the party.
All right, so let's go back to my original question. I'm in Florida. I go to the primary. Let's say I vote for Donald Trump, and everybody else votes their way. We're talking here about, you know, Florida. I know every state's different. You can, mm-hmm, use a different state if you want as an example. Then a certain number of votes are cast for the different parties. Then what happens? It's voted on in states that have the delegate that have to choose whoever the most was, and then how does it get to a superdelegate? Do you see where I'm trying to draw that line up to? I'm at the bottom. How is that vote going up to the top? Because it's different in every state. That's really confusing to most people, even to me.
Now, you vote for your candidate. Is Florida a winner-take-all state, Andy, in the Republican side?
I think so.
I think it is.
Florida, I think, is a winner-take-all state. So if you – and by the way, Laura, you can only vote in the primary if you're a registered party member in most states.
Okay.
You can only vote in the party you're registered to. So a Democrat can't register as a Republican so that they can vote for the weakest candidate and affect the election, the outcome of the election. You must be, in most states, a registered party member.
So if I were an independent and I wanted to change to Republican, I'd have to go re-register?
Yes. You have to register to vote in your party's primary in most states. But then you vote for Donald Trump. If the majority of Republicans in Florida in the primary voted for Trump, then he wins all of the delegates, and when they go to the convention, those delegates are theoretically supposed to vote for Donald Trump.
Okay. Well, let me ask Andy then. What happens if they don't? Because that might happen.
Well, there was just a court case in Virginia, and I'd like to hear what Barbara thinks of this, that says that you cannot punish a delegate for being what they call faithless, not doing what he or she is pledged to do, that they actually are, Virginia decided, free to do what they want without penalty. So the people trying to stop Trump are very happy about this court ruling. We'll see.
But what would be the point of having someone that's pledged to do something? Because then they're not doing the will of the people.
Well, but Lori, sometimes there's always been a philosophical debate going way back to the founding of the country in all democracies, whether people who are representing you should follow just the will of the people, or whether or not on some occasions, if they feel very strongly, they should follow their own conscience.
Okay.
It's a debate. When the Continental Congress was debating signing the Declaration of Independence, when that was on the floor, it was decided that that vote had to be unanimous, that we weren't going to go into a war against Britain unless all of the states agreed to the declaration, because we weren't going to split the nation up into pieces, pull some states away from, some colonies away from a mother country and not others. There was one delegate from the South holding out. And after a conversation with John Adams and some considerable correspondence, he decided that the will of the people who sent him might have been to stay with England, but after being in Congress, after seeing what he saw, he decided to vote for independence. He said his own conscience so dictated. So it is a philosophical debate that's gone on since the founding of the country.
All right. Now, let's talk about possible reforms, because my first reform would be, you know, that it should be a federal rule so that every state is treated the same way when it comes to it. So I want to get your ideas. Barbara, let's start with you. What are some possible reforms?
I don't know that I would go for federal control of the primaries, but I do think that there should be some reform. I think it should be proportional in all states. Whatever proportion of the popular vote you win, that's the number of delegates you should get at the convention. I'm not wild about the superdelegates.
Okay. And Andy, your thoughts?
I would like to see a debate about whether to do it by popular vote. It's not that I want to change it and eliminate the Electoral College, because it has some benefits, but I think it's interesting with the technology we have that candidates could reach the whole country in a way they couldn't before, and mm-hmm. that might make a popular vote for the presidency theoretically make sense. You know, four times we've had the candidate elected president who did not get the most popular votes, and we've survived that. So,
all right. Well, what are your thoughts, Andy, on eliminating caucuses?
Absolutely. I am for eliminating caucuses. There are two things. One, as Barbara said, it's more time-consuming. It's much more difficult for the voter. So it depresses turnout. And when you depress turnout, you get the most extreme, you know, the people who are most right-wing and left-wing at the respective caucuses. And That is not good, and I see no one of the reforms I would go for, besides eliminating caucuses, is just making voting easier, you know, have more early voting, because when lines are 5 hours long, it's mm-hmm. you're going to depress turnout. And there's the whole issue about, you know, Republicans in some states are trying to depress turnout because the demographics of the country are moving against them, and they feel that restrictions on voting will serve them well. It's certainly not it's an idea that has come not because of there's virtually no voter fraud. It's a non-existent problem, so the whole issue is to depress turnout.
I'm going to jump in. I remember visiting Florida before I lived here back in, I want to say, 2005, and there were problems here in Florida with the voting, the electronic voting.
That was the Al Gore election, the Bush-Gore election?
Yes.
Yeah, but that was a problem with ballots. There might have been corruption in that election. We'll never really know.
But it would be
those kinds of problems are rare.
And even, you know, the way it happened in Florida was not, there was all this debate with the hanging chads, what certain ballots said. That is a very unusual and easily avoidable situation. But the fraud, you know, the old jokes about from Chicago, you know, vote early, vote often. That doesn't happen, and dead people are not turning out the way they used to.
At the
polls.
The system really is not that fraudulent, and for the number of times that something does go wrong, there's a certain statistical tolerance, and generally speaking, the man in the past who wins the popular vote is the one who wins the election. The electors in the Electoral College, more than delegates to the primaries, are bound to vote the way the state goes.
Okay. One thing I personally would like to see, and I don't remember studying this in school, is, and I don't, you know, if you're in a specific state, it's almost like you need each state, there should be an education. Maybe it's available online. I don't know how your particular state works, because that's where I think people become confused. So if they read something on another state, they automatically assume, like I would have, that everything applies to the same states. Now, I've read quite a bit, so I see some states do it one way and some states do it another. But no one actually explains it in simple terms. It seems to be explained in complicated terms where people just don't understand it.
Democracy is difficult. It requires an educated electorate.
Okay.
People have to understand. Now, when I went to school, all of this was taught. But anybody who watches the news, anybody who watches CNN or Fox, regardless of your political persuasion, this whole issue of the primaries and the general election and the Electoral College has been explained ad infinitum in the last 6 months.
Well,
so
I think they maybe
you
need
really
to
have to turn yourself, turn off.
Okay.
All access to news in order not to have had any understanding of what's going on.
Okay.
I just want to say one thing about the Electoral College, and Barbara started this point, that there has never been an election that didn't go the way that the electors in the Electoral College changed their minds and therefore elected someone else. In the Bush-Gore election, one elector from the District of Columbia withheld her vote from Al Gore because she was protesting the fact that the District of Columbia had no representative in Congress, but that had no effect on the outcome of the election.
Okay.
And that is a rare thing when an elector does not do. She was supposed to vote for Gore, and she didn't.
Andy, there was one very strange exception, which was the election of 1800, Jefferson. It was the first time we had a contested election in this country, the first time there really were two candidates. And the one thing the Founding Fathers did not think of when they set up the Electoral College, the rule was the person who gets the most votes is president, the person who gets the second most votes is vice president. Well, the way it worked in 1800, they all voted the way they were supposed to, and Jefferson and Burr tied in the Electoral College. And Alexander Hamilton fought vigorously for Jefferson's election against Burr. And some electors, they had another vote, and there was a change in the vote, and Jefferson won, and Burr came in second. After that, a constitutional amendment was passed saying you vote for them separately
okay.
in the Electoral College.
All right.
And what you also had at the beginning, and you had it with Adams and Jefferson, I believe, where the president and vice president were from different parties.
That's correct.
And and you can imagine how well that would work. And so,
yeah.
Well, but there was a sense then of compromise for the public good, and also I think back with the founding fathers, your politicians were also your statesmen. They were also your political philosophers. There wasn't quite the self-serving attitude you see now, or the everything done to get reelected attitude you see now. This failure to compromise is really a very disturbing development.
Right. Well, I'm going to ask you guys to hold on for one moment. I'm going to do a short commercial break.
Do you suffer from back, neck, or body pain? Do you suffer from migraines or have jaw or face pain? Has conventional medicine failed you? Were you injured or in an accident? Call chiropractic physician Dr. Dan Maddock at 813-935-1664. Dr. Dan has helped thousands of patients gain relief for more than 30 years. Dr. Dan is caring, gentle, and takes his time with each patient. He's also a past president of the International Craniopathic Society, a special certification of only 300 chiropractors worldwide. Dr. Dan helps patients from the neck up and the neck down. Dr. Dan accepts most insurance plans. Don't continue to live in pain. Call 813-935-1664. 1664 today. That's 813-935-1664, and get on track to better health.
And welcome back to the show. Andy Feinberg and Barbara Chernow with me. We're talking about primaries, general elections, and the Electoral College. Now, on the commercial break, I heard you guys talking about a JFK anomaly. So why don't you talk about that?
Well, he really didn't win. the anomaly.
That's true.
Mayor Daley of Chicago, who was a supporter, somehow an awful lot of last-minute people voted for Kennedy, and a lot of them don't seem to have been alive at the time. But he won Chicago, and he won Illinois, and that tipped it in his favor.
And, you know, Daley worked with the mob, oddly enough, to steal the election. And Richard Nixon, who was running against JFK, knew it had been stolen. And I think it was his finest moment. He decided for the good of the country not to fight it, that, you know, it could go on for a long time without a designated president. And we were very much in the Cold War then, and in fact the Cuban Missile Crisis happened in 1962, so the idea of not having a president,
not a good idea.
And who knows what would have happened had he fought it, how it would have played out and how long it would have taken.
It is a sign of maturity and wisdom that none of the candidates, the four times that the man who won the popular vote did not win the college and therefore the presidency, there has never been a less than peaceful transition of government in the United States from one president to another. The outcome of the election is determined. The loser goes on national television. He might have spent millions, billions of dollars, goes on television and says, I'm now the loyal opposition. I've called the winner. I've congratulated them. I will continue to support my values and ideas, but I've lost the election. The gracefulness with which we go from one administration to another, a tradition we've inherited from the British, is a very impressive and stabilizing influence. And that is another thing that's a bit disturbing about this election.
Because that's not going to happen this election. Something's going to happen. I get the feeling that either way, something bad's going to happen.
No, I don't bad's going to happen, but I can't imagine Donald Trump giving a gracious concession speech if he loses.
Right, I can't either. But I was struck yesterday by the fact that President Obama and former President Bush spoke at the same memorial service. They both spoke beautifully, and there was no partisanship.
No, they came together.
Right.
Well,
and in fact, Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush are friends, and they do a lot of, or have done a lot of good work together. I just want to add a little point. Barbara's absolutely right, but there have been cases where in 1824, Andrew Jackson got plurality of electoral votes and a plurality of the vote, but Henry Clay, through his support to John Quincy Adams, John Quincy Adams became the president and selected Henry Clay as Secretary of State, and Jackson supporters called this a corrupt bargain. We don't know exactly what happened. And in fact, it may have been exactly what they thought, but it was not a crime. I mean, that kind of thing happens all the time. And when Hayes was elected in 1876, even though he lost the popular vote, a lot of people call him Rutherford B. Hayes for the rest of his days. Even though it doesn't, there was fraud on both sides, and Grant appointed a commission that decided that Hayes was the winner. So,
you know, the John Quincy Adams Andrew Jackson election is interesting as a comparison to today, because John Quincy Adams represented the old line. He was the last president to come out of the founding fathers' generation. And Jackson represented a very new dynamic, a popular, more popular candidate, one who actually went out and campaigned. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess a lot of people now don't realize that for a long time, presidents did not go out and campaign. Surrogates campaigned for them. And until Franklin Roosevelt, they never went to the convention and accepted the nomination. The party appointed a delegation to go to the president's home and inform him of his nomination.
Okay.
So the world has changed.
The world has changed.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the general election, the indirect elections. Andy, can you give me what's the basis in the Constitution?
The basis in the Constitution, although, was that the state legislatures would nominate electors who would then get to choose the president. So, and Barbara's original point is true. You know, it was, you know, the people were being represented, but it was indirect. Mm-hmm. And that was, in fact, we don't even have vote totals for most of the original elections. We don't know exactly what happened. And, but it's, I think the most important thing where people should not be cynical is, the Electoral College is very close to the popular vote. It's different in some ways, and the electoral map is very important and at the moment gives an advantage to Democrats. But, you know, I would hate – people should vote. I mean, one of the arguments for going to the popular vote is that it would increase turnout, that a lot of people in states that are – absolutely red or absolutely blue. I mean, I know my vote for president isn't going to count. I'm gonna go vote anyway. But New York is probably not going to be closely contested.
Also, Gloria, originally, as Andy points out, the state legislators chose the delegates, the electors, to the college. But now that's done by popular vote.
All right. Now I want to go back a little bit. Contested conventions. Give me a definition.
Say that again?
Contested conventions. Let's use Donald Trump as an example.
Oh, that means that you don't know who's going to win the nomination until you get to the convention, and most conventions were contested because there was no primary system.
Okay.
So you got to the floor of the convention, and you didn't know who was going to win, and the delegates campaigned, the nominees campaigned, their surrogates campaigned. And it could take many ballots before a decision was made. It's only in recent time that you go into the conventions and the nomination is pro forma.
And in fact, this year, with the Republicans there, for many months it was looking as if it could well be a contested convention.
They were more fun.
They were fun. Well, this, you know, and what's so, this is the week that the Rules Committee is meeting and to decide what the rules are going to be for choosing the, you know, whether Trump wins or not, and which is a very strange thing.
But well, conventions were fun to watch, and you have famous people from each state would stand up and give a little speech. You know, the great state of Margaret Truman would do this. The great state of Missouri, the home of Harry Truman, and the place where such and such first happened, what a cat's throat for. And it was a whole, it was democracy in action. It was fun to watch.
Okay. Well, let's go on a little bit to the Electoral College, Barbara. What's the constitutional basis and subsequent amendments?
Well, the constitutional basis was just as we discussed earlier. Okay. The Founding Fathers were interested in protecting all parts of the country and all people in the country. So it was the House of Representatives is the House of the people. It's a popular election. It is based upon population in each state. The Senate is less the people's house because there are two per state regardless of size. And the, you have in the Electoral College, Andy, it's the number of representatives plus senators?
Yes.
For each state, plus I think the District of Columbia may get three votes.
They get three. So that gets
even
you to 538.
Right. And each of the electors is supposed to vote the way the majority of the popular vote went in that state.
Right. All right, what about subsequent amendments?
The only amendment for the Electoral College was the one in 1801, after the Jefferson election, when it was decided that they vote for president and vice president separately. Other than that, I don't think the Electoral College has ever been changed.
Well, one thing that's it's not the Electoral College. If no one gets 270 votes,
right,
which is possible this year, given we'll see how Gary Johnson does as the Libertarian candidate, then the election gets thrown into the House of Representatives. The election for president, oddly, the one for vice president goes into the Senate, and the Republicans control the House. So they will clearly choose the Republican, presumably choose the Republican candidate that gets thrown into the
House. Electoral College, too, in part, and I don't think the Founding Fathers had this in mind because political parties were not such a clear issue when the Constitution was written, but it does discourage third-party candidacies on the whole. Because there's really no way a third-party candidate can win. So a third-party candidate becomes a spoiler.
Okay.
And there are two times a third-party candidate came in second in the vote. In 1860, Breckinridge of the Southern Democratic Party beat out Douglas, who was the regular Democrat. And in 1912, Teddy Roosevelt finished second.
Right.
Running as a third party.
That was a strange election, though.
Yes.
Well, I wish you two had been my history teachers. I'm learning a lot more in this show than I think I did in school.
I think it's important, Lori, I think there are two messages from me, at least.
Okay.
Your vote counts. Go out and vote. We are a nation of immigrants. We all come. We're all descended from people who came here because they were suffering in their homelands. And when they got here, they valued incredibly the freedoms that they had, particularly the Bill of Rights and the right to vote. Your great-grandfather was so afraid that he wouldn't get home from work in time to vote that he would stand in the polling place at 5:30 in the morning and always be number one. It meant that much to him that his vote counted.
Right.
So it's important that people remember that. These privileges we have, very few people in other countries have. So we should value it. It's important that people vote. It's also important that they remember we're a country of laws. And if you don't like the system, you don't like the way things are going, you elect people who can change the laws. And laws are changed by Congress, not by the president. So promises that candidates make very often are things they can't do if elected.
Okay.
You have to understand how this works in order to make an informed decision. But please, everyone should go out and vote. It really does matter.
All right. And Andy, got about 2 minutes to wrap the show. Give me your final thoughts.
I agree with Barbara completely, and no one valued democracy more than my grandmother, who was born in Russia and was just so in love with America, you know, for her entire life, and it was inspiring. We have a very recent example, the election of 2000, and the transition, you know, it was at a certain point, the fight ended, and Democrats and Republicans said that's what the Supreme Court decided. And in fact, Al Gore, as the vice president, presided over the reading of the Electoral College results, showing that he lost because of Florida. And, you know, I bet one of these days we are going to have a state that where the vote is so close in a presidential election, and it's like decided by 1,000, that a lot of people who didn't show up are going to feel bad. And one of the things, you know, in 1860, 81.5% of eligible voters voted. And in our last presidential election, it was 57.5%.
That's
and
bad.
That is, Barbara and I would both, please, we... Let's get closer to the way the numbers used to be, because this is a gift we have.
Right. You have to get out. You have to get out and vote. Well, I want to thank both of you for joining me. Barbara, how can you be reached?
If people want to reach me, they can send me an email at bchernow, C-H-E-R-N-O-W, at chernow.com.
Okay. And Andy, how can you be reached?
They can go to me. Baby Don Don on my Facebook website, and leave a message. I will respond.
Great. I'm looking forward to reading that Facebook page. Thanks again for joining me. Have you both on a future show again, and we'll talk soon. And tune in again next week for the World of Lori Zook.